there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 321. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We actually have two amazing guests for you this week doing similar work in two very different states. Let's start with our first guest. For the past 8+ years, AJ Bockelman has been the executive director of PROMO, Missouri's statewide organization advocating for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender equality through legislative action, electoral politics, grassroots organizing, so much more. We're going to talk all about it. He is a longtime volunteer and community activist, including serving as a community volunteer for Challenge Metro, a gay and lesbian crisis line. AJ joined the PROMO Board of Directors in 2006 and previously served on the Human Rights Campaign Board of Governors for 5 years. AJ has been recognized as a Bonnet Fellow, attending the Harvard Kennedy School of Government program for state and local elected officials, and he's a 2013 alumni of Focus St. Louis Leadership in the St. Louis class. The St. Louis Business Journal recognized AJ's contributions as a diverse business leader in 2013, and he's got some pretty darn exciting career plans coming up that we're going to talk all about. But first, AJ, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Well, thank you very much, Ken.
We have so much ground to cover, my friend. Are you ready?
I'm ready and willing.
All right. So from what I am gathering from my crack research online, we started out with 15 years in human resources within the travel industry.
Correct. Immediately after college, I'd actually started with a cruise line and kind of worked my way up there, stayed in the corporate world for several years and enjoyed it, but I like to say that I was blessed with the layoff. And I kind of knew that I wanted to go into nonprofit management. Ended up in an after-school program for a couple of years and had been on the board of HRC. Started to get more involved in the local politics and went on the board of PROMO, and I think the rest is history.
All right. Well, first, let's get the important question out of the way. Do you retain any discounts with any cruise lines?
Unfortunately not.
AJ.
And I probably know enough that I no longer want to travel on a cruise line.
And now with that, I never wanted to travel on a cruise line, just from you saying that right there. It's amazing. So you make this big switch to working in the nonprofit sector. Was there a moment when you thought, okay, I want to make this transition?
Oh, definitely. Several years ago, whenever I started getting involved with the Human Rights Campaign, it actually kind of sparked a strong interest in, you know, just general nonprofit work, community engagement. And I sought an opportunity to do that a number of different times. And then when I ended up with the airlines, I was blessed with the layoff, and it just made that switch a little bit easier to do.
Nice. Now, we'll talk about the specific services and everything that you provide and everything logistical, but what do you get on that emotional side from devoting yourself to this nonprofit work?
Well, I think one story that I've told frequently, or a few times at least, is that growing up, I actually was almost the family priest.
Mm.
I had actually spent my summers at the seminary between freshman and sophomore, pretty much almost every high school year, with the exception before my senior. I did go to the seminary and had greatly contemplated becoming a priest.
Mm.
And I realized that at one point, I turned my back on that because I realized I was running from my own sexuality. And I was just kind of hiding from myself. But I did definitely have a strong sense of community.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I was looking at stepping into that kind of a role. And I didn't really experience that kind of community or that sense of community until I started getting involved with nonprofit work in general. And then I definitely have felt that in the last 8 years being at the helm of PROMO.
Now, you're working in more of that profit sector, that kind of corporate sector, and you're making this transition. Did you have to explain to your family and friends? We always talk about this coming out process of when people make that transition to nonprofit work. Did you have to do some convincing of those around you?
My parents were of the Depression generation.
Okay.
So they never really had a context for people really working waiting tables on tips in even... To a great extent, didn't really have a context of what nonprofit work was. And I think my dad's first statement to me is something like, so you're going to be bugging people for money? So they didn't really have a context for it, but they came to understand and appreciate a little bit of what I did.
Now, can we just take 2 seconds? Because I think the human rights campaign certainly has been getting knocked around a little bit. Can you tell us the virtues? Sell us on the human rights campaign and the great work that they do from your vantage point.
Well, being in a state-based group, you know, one of the criticisms for years really had been that we weren't doing anything at the state level.
Right.
And whenever I had left the board of HRC, then those board of governors, not the board of directors, which was mainly their fundraising board. I really did have a good picture of the organization overall, but I didn't have a context for what that state-based work was looking like. And I will say that, you know, in my early years at this organization, at Promo, I did not have probably the best or strongest relationship with HRC.
Mm-hmm.
That was dating back to, you know, when I first took over, it was long before they had the ENDA debacle
right.
in Congress and how that all played out. But I'll be honest that in the last couple of years, HRC has probably been one of our absolute strongest national partners by providing both funds on the ground. So, for example, we just had a ballot initiative in Springfield, Missouri earlier this spring. They provided considerable funds on the ground and staff to help us run that program. And the last couple of years, I've also been involved with our legislative efforts in either providing some support work behind the scenes or some lobbying lift. So they have been much more engaged and involved in what they have in prior years. And I think it's an intentional effort on a couple of different fronts. One, it is difficult now to see much movement on the federal level. You have some great movement on the federal agencies. You know, for example, HHS coming out with some guidelines today that are up for review to extend full protections for trans individuals' health care. But then everything in Congress is going to be deadlocked for a while.
Yeah.
We're not going to see many things like the Equality Act move just too far in the near term. So the work is really more at the state-based level. So I think that they're sincerely looking to build better partnerships at the state level where most of the action will happen over the next 3 to 5 years.
There you go. All right. Let's turn our attention to the great state of Missouri. I will tell you, AJ, the only thing I know about Missouri, I've only been there twice. My sister is there, so I have two of my nieces and one of my nephews. They're in Missouri. All I know about Missouri are the two bar mitzvahs I've been to. I feel like there's probably a lot more going on there than that.
We have a little bit more going on than just bar mitzvahs.
On behalf of the Missouri Tourism Board, sell our audience on the great state of Missouri.
It is a very eclectic state, and I definitely think that the slogan with the show me state, that you do have to kind of see it to believe it. It's a pristine state. There's some beautiful areas. It's a very diverse state. You have some strong urban areas like St. Louis and Kansas City that have a vibrant nightlife, very, very gay-friendly in each of those cities, the city proper, and it's a pretty active community overall. KC's got a beautiful art scene, very engaged community around the ballet and the Nelson Atkins Museum. St. Louis, we have a broad, diverse cultural and art program at a number of different levels. And the people are pretty engaging. We have our challenges, but people are also pretty engaging.
All right. When the ad for the executive director, I would imagine that you were sitting on the board of Promo, and that's where you first learned, okay, there's an executive director of opening. Is that where this came about?
Correct.
And did you immediately think to yourself, yep, that's going to be me?
It did kind of pass through my head. I was close to the prior executive director. I really admired where she was trying to take the organization and what she was trying to bring to the table with it overall. But it was very difficult because we were seen as primarily a grungy grassroots organization. And it's a difficult slog. These are not necessarily easy positions because you have to every day put on a battle armor and hone yourself to the battles ahead, whatever they may be. And but I saw that, and I've not always been one to shy away from a challenge. I've not been afraid of it. And whenever the position became open, I did think about it long and hard, and went to the board and said, I'll step down while you consider this process. And ultimately, after a few interviews, they did accept me for the position. They did a full search, though, so it wasn't just that they handed the reins to me.
No, we believe that you beat out some other people, AJ. We like to believe that, and it's true. It's true. Now, before we get into the specifics, you know, we've had the great opportunity to speak to so many statewide LGBT directors of various organizations. Talk to me about what is specific about doing LGBT work in the state of Missouri. How do you approach it there that someone might approach it differently in another state?
One of the key things that's been very different for us is that we have a tremendous partner in our backyard called Missouri Foundation for Health. Let me back up slightly.
Yeah.
Several years ago, in 2009, roughly, I said that we were not unlike what we're seeing at the federal level right now. We knew that we were going to have a mostly friendly governor and a pretty difficult legislature to work with. And so we set out to try to identify how could we still advance. We constantly ask ourselves the question, how can we improve the lives of the LGBT community on a statewide basis? And so through that lens, we really had to focus that lens because it seemed as if at one point people really had a lot of expectations what the organization could do to them, for them on a broad number of levels. And we had to hone it and say, look, our focus is anything we could be done in the state capital and at that level within the state. And so at the time, in 2009, we had just elected a governor who, as a Democrat, Democratic Attorney General, had sent a letter to California saying that they should not implement marriages because it would be a burden to Missouri. And looking at the opponent at the time, the Republican, we knew that he was not going to be an ally. And so we looked at his fundraising and we said, okay, here are the big gay donors in KC and in St. Louis, the grass top, big LGBT people that have donated to this campaign. We started calling them and just said, look, we're not going to ask you not to support the governor, but you have the ear of the governor and you can raise these concerns to them. That letter was not appropriate. And we would like you as the governor to consider appointing out individuals to committees and to boards, that you should consider extending an executive order to cover all state employees. So that was the start of our public policy initiative. And that's evolved over the course of time because we started to see a lot of information. Our SAGE of Metro St. Louis affiliate has been a great partner of ours in this project. And the ED there and I started seeing a lot of data come down to the federal level, information about health that really we thought was not getting in the right hand. So we started a series of roundtables with some of the health professionals that we knew, and we started to extend that circle wider. One of the major foundations in the state, Missouri Foundation for Health, which is a billion-dollar endowed healthcare foundation, got wind of what we were doing, and they said, we should be funding this. And I initially said, well, thank you, but unfortunately, we're not a health policy organization. I said, well, actually, what you're doing is fully health policy, and we should be funding you to help support this. And I think this is, I'm kind of focusing on this piece of it because it's where I believe some of our organizations are likely going as they continue to evolve.
Yeah.
I think many of the political fights may be waning over time. In the near future, we still have a lot of protection to do. We have to win basic protections, non-discrimination protections in a state like Missouri. But even those are starting to be whittled away by other relative policies that are being issued. So those are the kinds of things that I see it working on in our future. In our case, with our health policy initiative, what we focus on are things like improving hospitals to have better policies. So the HRC puts out a metric called the Health Equality Index. Mm-hmm. And for years, Missouri only had two hospitals, one in St. Louis and one in Kansas City, even hitting that lift. Last year was the first time after our coordinated effort where we actually uplifted Missouri to the first in the Midwest, number six on their ranking around the country, because we now have 54 hospitals representing roughly 19 healthcare systems in the state, where we've trained over 2,600 employees on LGBT cultural competency, and that's reflective of roughly 120 different pro-LGBT policy changes with these hospital systems.
I mean, that's some actual change, AJ.
We're pretty proud of that. I think it's something that is a growing area. Our cultural competency trainings, we've been getting calls from unique sectors. Recently had some municipalities inquire about the training. most notably Ferguson, Missouri, as well as several other institutions such as the correctional system. So there's a need for better cultural policy training, and we're starting to fill that need.
Now, if I were to go talk to your staff there at Promo, and don't think that I won't, AJ, how do you think that they would describe you as an executive director?
Oh, I'm not good with these kind of games. I think that one of the things that I will say that I probably have one of the most professional and qualified staffs in the country.
Yeah.
Because I try to train and look for people with leadership skill sets, because in an advocacy organization, especially one that kind of bridges between the political side and this much more robust nonprofit side, I need people that are able to think quickly on their feet. We all make mistakes, but I expect that if a mistake is made, that people understand what they need to do to make the corrections and turn around. And to me, that's the definition of leadership, that you own up to whatever's going on, and you move forward, and you build upon that, because I think that's a critical piece. And so what would my staff say about me? I don't know, that I'm always on my email or always on the phone.
That's important. All right, well, we have to get to the big news. I feel like it was maybe, 13 or 14 minutes ago, AJ, you announced that you actually will be leaving Promo.
Correct. It's been a bit of a process, because I have tried to figure out when is the appropriate time to make an exit from the organization. And these are the kinds of positions that aren't necessarily just a 40-hour-a-week position.
Right.
Many weekends, evenings, a lot of different things like that. And I've really, truly enjoyed it. And I'm a different person than I was 8 years ago. I'd like to think a more learned person through the experiences that I've gone through and helped lead the organization through. But in the last year, I did have a lot of losses in my personal life. We lost my mother, my brother, and my father all within a three-month stretch.
Wow.
And a number of other family health issues have popped up. So that's really caused me to reflect a little bit more. I want to take a little bit of time with my family. In the immediate near term, I'm stepping down in the middle of October, and I'm planning to take a little bit of time with my husband, Jeremy, help my family back in Indiana, take care of the family estate, and then turn my eye to the future, hoping to jump into something by beginning of next year.
Nice. Now, are you one of those folks that is going to be able to disconnect from this work? I mean, you've been so immersed in it for so long. Are you going to do the succession planning piece where you hand things over, or do you see yourself as someone who is going to feel that need to stay connected in that way?
Well, on the succession planning piece, we've always had a joking plan of if AJ gets hit by a bus tomorrow sort of plan.
Okay.
So, I've always made sure that our deputy director was cross-trained on all these different pieces, and Steph Perkins, who is our deputy director, is stepping into the interim role. I think there's a plan for roughly a six-month window while they consider and do a search, as well as consider Steph and looking to step into the full-time role. So that's yet to be seen. As far as disconnecting, I think it's healthy, too. And I admit that it has been a little bit difficult, but with some of the changes for my family, a couple of different times this year in helping my family overall, I did, put my iPhone down and turn my computer off, and I really didn't even check it for up to 2 weeks at a time, a few different points. And while I did find it a little bit difficult, I did also feel that it was very healthy for me to do that.
Yeah.
And I think that at times you have to take care of yourself, because it will only make you a better activist if you do practice good self-care.
Nice. Talk to me about one of those challenges that maybe you weren't able to successfully conquer, that you may look back on a little bit differently as you walk away.
Well, I kept saying to my board and some of our main followers of the organization, I really want to win one of the big pieces, and that was non-discrimination or anti-bullying. And we significantly moved the needle on both of those.
Mm-hmm.
Anti-bullying, I think, is something that has become very convoluted, and many of our state groups are stepping to the side on that, still working in coalition. But non-discrimination was really my baby that I felt needed to really pass. And we did moved the needle considerably. I honestly believe that we have a significant body of Republicans in the state who will vote for it. If we had a clean vote, when I say clean vote, not necessarily have something loaded up with a bunch of different amendments, I believe that we would actually have this passed, because we've got a great body of moderates who understand the issue, you know, and even some of our older Republicans have just really amazed me. Like, I remember this 65-year-old grandfather that we had never really fully approached about supporting it, but it was up for his committee and one that he sat on, and one of our good colleagues in the legislature went up to him one afternoon and said, "So what are our chances of getting you to vote for this?" And he turned to him and said, "I'm glad you finally asked. My niece and nephew are gay and lesbian, and you know, I really don't care what they do. I want to protect it. I'm a yes vote."
Yeah.
And, you know, it reminded us that we never know who our allies are. And I do believe that we're close to winning this battle, but I'm going to let the next generation take up that part of the fight.
There you go. And they will. And they will. That's, we have to have that hope and we have to have that belief. You know, we talk often when we have your colleagues on the show about the challenges of getting more people of color involved in this work and getting them on our boards and getting them on our staffs and getting them to volunteer. And I would imagine that all of that takes on perhaps even a more acute focus there in Missouri, as you mentioned, Ferguson, before. Talk to me about doing that kind of work and reaching out to even more communities.
Well, I think that a great thing about Ferguson, because it's been a very difficult and painful experience for our broader St. Louis region to watch and be a part of, because there are some really deep-seated racist aspects of our region. I mean, that's just a reality we have to be brutally honest about. But at the same time, we're seeing some incredible young queer women of color who are stepping up and really leading the fight. And there's the Millennial Activists United is a newer organization that formed out of the roots of what was going on in Ferguson last summer. And the two young queer women that run it, they're a couple actually, they're breaking down barriers like we've never seen before, because they're working within the predominantly African-American parts of the city. And people don't care that they're lesbian, that they're a couple. They just see them doing this incredible work to stand up and face racism head on.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to see. So I think empowering people like that is incredibly important.
Huge, huge. We have all these listeners who are hearing you talk and thinking, well, gosh, I want to get involved. There's got to be more that I can do. What would you tell our listeners? How can they get involved with the great work that Promo is doing?
Well, you can always check us out at promoonline.org, follow us on Twitter at Promo Missouri, or on Facebook, Promo Missouri. First and foremost, the biggest thing that I always tell any group of people is be out, be active, be proud, because that breaks down more barriers than anything else.
My favorite question to ask you, to ask all of your colleagues always on this show, I give you the floor, sir. I will ask you, how would you go about singing the praise and virtue of your staff, your volunteers, and your board?
We have done an incredible amount of work in the last 8 years, and the legacy of the organization going back nearly 30 years now. We have moved mountains in the state of Missouri at times when people really did not think that this state would move anywhere on LGBT issues. We have moved mountains, and it's been through the actions of our staff that have helped coordinate it, our volunteers who show up to do everything from phone bank to stuff, envelopes to walk around the doors of the Capitol, to our donors that help keep the doors open. They've truly been the backbone of the organization. I've just had the honor of serving as the face.
I love it. I love it. All right. We end with this question, and I think it's an important one. You know, this is tough work, AJ. You've articulated it so well of just it can be draining work. There are a lot of battles to be fought. There are certainly many victories. For those who are listening, who are engaged in this work, who, you know, maybe aren't taking the time for themselves and are just trying to figure out how do they recharge, how do they keep themselves going in this work? You know, as you said, you've certainly had just an unbelievably challenging year, you know, and our thoughts are with you and your family on all of that. What do you have to say to our listeners to keep them going?
You won't be effective unless you find a way to recharge yourself. And if that's stepping away or, you know, curling up with a good book or watching a bad sci-fi movie, you have to do it in order to be effective.
There it is. All right, everybody, this is what you need to do. All of our listeners, you need to stroll on over to promoonline.org. There are tons of links there. You can learn all about the great work that happens when you go to that place where equality starts here. Amazing work being done in Missouri. AJ, we're so excited to see what comes next for you. If you need two guaranteed votes, I can get my sister and my brother-in-law to vote for you for whatever it is that you're doing. So you let me know. It's good to start out knowing that you have two votes.
I will keep that in mind.
All right. I'm just putting that out there. For everything else that you and everyone at Promo have been doing for years and years and will continue to do, my hope is that you know that it is valued just all across the incredible state of Missouri, that there have been so many victories, and just knowing that you guys are out there fighting for equality, providing a voice for our LGBTQ brothers and sisters all across that state of Missouri. This is crucial, crucial work, and you have the thanks of everybody you have affected.
Thank you.
All right. AJ, keep doing what you're doing. We are so excited to hear what comes next for you, sir.
I'm looking forward to figuring that out myself as well.
When Louis came home to the flat, he hung up his coat and his hat. He gazed all around, but no wifey he found. So he said, "Where can Flossie be at?" A note on the table he spied. He read it just once, then he cried. It ran, "Louis dear, it's too slow for me here, so I think I will go for a ride. Meet me in St. Louis, Louis, meet me at the fair. Don't tell me the lights are shining any place but there. We will dance the hoochie coochie."
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, that's everything happening in the great state of Missouri, but what's going on in the great state of Kentucky? Let's check in right now with our second guest. Chris Hartman is the director of Fairness Campaign, an organization that seeks to dismantle oppression and build an inclusive community where all individuals are valued and empowered to reach their full potential. We're going to talk all about that. Previously, Chris served as Congressman John Yarmuth's 2008 campaign press secretary. He served as an AmeriCorps volunteer in service to America, Avista, in St. Louis, and Chris served as Philadelphia director of the Democratic National Committee's open air grassroots fundraising effort in the 2004 presidential election. Chris founded and produced Project Improv, two long-form improvisational theater troupes in St. Louis and Louisville. Gosh, I love improv. We're going to talk about that. And now, right this very second, Chris Hartman, well, he's here with us. Chris, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Ken, I am delighted and honored to be with you. Thank you.
We are delighted and honored to have you. We have so much ground to cover. Are you ready?
Absolutely.
How would you characterize your path? I look at your background and see, all right, I'm seeing a lot of advocacy work. I'm seeing a lot of nonprofit work. Are those right. The dominant threads?
Those are very dominant threads, but my theater background is just as dominant. I sort of quip that, you know, the theater and politics, I bounce back and forth largely because the contracts are about the same length and the pay is about the same.
So, there you go. Yeah.
About every 6 months, I'd have to get a new gig, and sometimes theater was paying, and sometimes politics was paying. So either way, though, all of my work, whether it was theater, or whether it was advocacy, or working for candidates, or working with nonprofits, was really all about seeking the betterment of our community. And even my improv was remarkably political. All of our other improvisers have these marvelous recurring characters that they would play every week when we had our shows. I only had one. I was consistently Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. So I could never extrapolate, divide my politics from my art. So it was always the same threat.
Were there times that you went home at night forgetting that you were not indeed Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld?
But fortunately, we were separated by a good 45 years or so. So when I looked in the mirror, I did okay.
All right.
And I can't say that I ever did a marvelous job impersonating him. He was just my favorite subject matter.
I love it. I love it. Well, I have to tell you, Chris, and I don't think this has ever come up in 7 years of doing this show. We never get to talk about AmeriCorps Vistas. I love AmeriCorps Vistas. Tell everybody what you did in those experiences.
AmeriCorps Vistas are a unique form of service here in the United States. It's basically the Peace Corps domestically. Peace Corps is 2 years and you go abroad. AmeriCorps is typically 1 year, or it can be extended to 2 years, and it's here at home. Vistas, Volunteers in Service to America, V-I-S-T-A, Vistas typically serve in an administrative capacity, oftentimes in a nonprofit setting. So when I was in America, an AmeriCorps Vista in 2005, I was working out of Rebuilding Together St. Louis, which is a nonprofit that rebuilds and repairs homes for low-income, elderly, and disabled homeowners. So, you know, that was a wonderfully fulfilling experience. The goal of an AmeriCorps Vista is to work sort of within the community that you serve, and also to have an experience of what it's like to live at just about poverty level. So there are, you know, there's a stipend paid to AmeriCorps Vistas, but it is right at about American poverty level. So, you know, it's a unique experience all around. It's a self-sacrificing one, but it really is one that is so necessary to providing services to those who are underserved in our community.
Now, I have to ask you, and I'm hoping for the answer that I want, so we're going to see how this goes. Were you a West Wing watcher?
Oh, of course.
Okay. So, Chris, this, I feel like this interview is as close as I have ever gotten to C.J. Craig. So the fact that you were a press secretary, I cannot tell you how exciting that is for me.
Well, that's marvelous. It was exciting for me as well. And to be honest, I had a very unique press secretary experience because I worked for, you know, arguably, at least in my mind, the smartest, best prepared congressman in the business. My congressman, John Yarmuth, he was a first term incumbent, so I was his press secretary when he was running for his first reelection. He was running against the same person that he had beat 2 years previously. This was a former five-term incumbent Republican congresswoman, Ann Northup, who was really a dismal representation of Louisville in Kentucky. That's the third congressional district. John Yarmuth narrowly beat her in 2006. And then when I came into the campaign in 2008, we had a resounding victory by almost 20 points that year against the same opponent. So things had really changed, and it's definitely a high-paced lifestyle and a very little personal time, phones ringing at all hours. And unfortunately for other press secretaries, they've got a lot more heavy lifting to do because they've got to write all of their candidates' speeches and give them all the talking points. Congressman Yarmuth, so well-read, so articulate. I think I wrote one speech for him. I noticed that he didn't glance at it once, and I said, oh, I get how this goes now.
There it is. There it is. I would imagine that your improv background helped you enormously as a press secretary.
Absolutely. As an improviser, we are at all times prepared for all things, and that's remarkably necessary in politics. So it helped as a press secretary. It has definitely helped in my capacity at the Fairness campaign as well.
You understand that I'm going to go on Facebook in a few minutes and I'm going to update my status to say that I just did an interview with C.J. Craig.
That's perfect. I'm honored to even be in the same sentence.
It's a resume builder for you as well, Chris. I'm just putting that out there.
Indeed. Oh, thank you.
All right. Now, you have tons and tons of experience in the great state of Kentucky, and I have to be honest with you. I know that it's not far from where I sit right now in Cleveland, Ohio. I know next to nothing about Kentucky. So on behalf of the Kentucky Tourism Board, sell us on the great state of Kentucky.
Oh, you got to come and see our bluegrass and drink our bourbons. We're all about it. It's the simple things in life here in Kentucky: horse races, bourbon. You know, there's nothing like wearing a bow tie, smoking a fine cigar, and sipping on some Woodford Reserve. You know, we're a very broad state. We're not a huge state population-wise, but there's a lot of rich history and culture here in Louisville, which is where I call home, where I was born, and where the Fairness Campaign is, where I work. We have a vibrant, really shocking to many folks, arts community, from theater to orchestra to visual arts to ballet to improv, really anything you could want, we've got it. And Louisville's motto, it's almost its official motto, is Keep Louisville Weird. So we really embrace folks who, you know, have a unique sense of themselves. We've got a beautifully diverse community, and I wouldn't want to live anywhere else.
There it is. I have to be honest with you. It was a struggle for me to keep listening after I heard Woodford Reserve. I just get excited.
Barrel bourbons abound here.
It's all about that. And by the way, if you're listening and you work for Woodford Reserve and you want to sponsor our show, we're fine with that. Totally.
Well, Brown Forman is one of the Fairness Campaign's biggest supporters, and they've got one of the most vibrant and robust LGBTQ business resource groups. So I'm certain they'd love to chat with you.
Look at that. Sorry, I'm updating my status. Just drank Woodford Reserve with CJ Craig. Okay, here we are. All right, that brings us to Fairness Campaign. And by the way, am I getting this correct? We should not be saying the Fairness Campaign.
You're right, Fairness Campaign. Oftentimes people say the Fairness Campaign, but yeah, just on our 501c3 and C4 corporation papers, yep, we're Fairness Campaign.
Let me read you a phrase and then you translate it for our listening audience. Seeks to dismantle oppression and build an inclusive community where all individuals are valued and empowered to reach their full potential.
Right. You know, a lot of folks see us as an LGBTQ civil rights organization, and we are that. But we were founded on the principles that dismantling systemic racism is a necessary and integral part of our work. You know, we feel very strongly at the Fairness Campaign that as long as one form of oppression persists, no form of oppression is ever going to desist. So we don't work on issues in silos. We are intentional that racism is sexism, is classism, is homophobia, that we've got to work on immigrants' rights, we've got to work on voting rights restoration, we've got to work on a living increased minimum wage for folks if we're ever going to seek full LGBTQ liberation. We take it very seriously, and we build our allies, our coalitions, and our partnerships across the state in that same manner.
Chris, you make it seem like intersectionality is important.
I love that you use the word. You know, in the dictionary, intersectionality does not exist. But in our lives, it does.
Yeah.
And that's the principle that, you know, we can't just bring one part of ourselves to the table. If I am, an immigrant, lesbian, mother of four, I don't want to walk into the room and just be one of those things. We've got to bring our whole selves to the table. And that's the way we do our movement work. You're supposed to bring your whole self. It's what makes people rich as individuals.
There it is. Now, let's back up a step. How did you, Chris Hartman, come to be involved with Fairness Campaign?
Well, it was a happy accident, I suppose. Or perhaps I should say the Fairness Campaign chose me in a way. Right after I was coming off of Congressman Yarmouth's reelection bid, and we won, we had a resounding victory. But anybody who works in politics knows that campaign staffs are dispensable. Congressman Yarmouth was already in Washington, so he already had a full congressional staff, and those of us who were working on his campaign staff didn't necessarily have jobs at the end of the campaign. But that's what we sign up for. So I was unemployed for a couple of months after the congressman's campaign, and I was also happy to take some time off. And three or four people, independent of one another, kept sort of mentioning to me that the Fairness Campaign was seeking its first ever director. Now, they'd already been around for about 18 years, but they'd never hired a director before. It just ended up seeming like the right fit. And let me tell you, it was like a Senate confirmation hearing to get the job. I went through three interviews. The first one was for about half of the board of directors. There were eight or nine people there. The second interview was for some of those same board members and additional folks, about eight or nine people again. And then the last interview, everybody in the community that worked with the Fairness Campaign in any sort of capacity was invited to come and grill me with whatever questions they had. So there were about 25 people in the room for my third round interview. I guess at that point I sort of knew what I was getting myself into, but I loved all of the folks who were giving me the third degree, and it felt great.
I should take this opportunity to pause and let you know, Chris, that your board is using this interview as part of your annual performance appraisal.
Well, I'm glad they're finally doing it on an annual basis now.
And then that just got said. So I don't know how that's going to work out for you, but we'll blow right by that. You know, we've had the great opportunity to talk to so many of your colleagues who are doing statewide LGBT work. What makes it different for you to do this work in Kentucky? How do you approach it differently given the context that you are in?
Well, every state is very different and every community is very different. And we, again, are intentional in our approach to organizing in Kentucky that we're not going to swoop in as the statewide organization, show up in a town and say, this is how we win and we need you all to come along with us. We wait until we're invited by local community leaders to work in a town. We come in, we meet with folks, we ask them what the resources they need to accomplish their goals are. And then we attempt to provide that for them. We found that to be the only model of success that works with local organizing and particularly with rural organizing. We could have never seen the successes that we have in eastern Kentucky without that approach. You know, the tiny Appalachian coal town of Vico, which rose to national prominence in 2013 when it became the smallest city in America to pass LGBT anti-discrimination fairness protections, we could not have won there if we had just sort of shown up one day and said, ah, hey, you need to do this. We got to know the folks there. We really settled in. We threw back a few shots at the police chief's Mexican restaurant 15 miles over in Hazard. And by heavens, we came to understand what the community was like and what they needed to move forward. And that's how we won. And in the past couple of years, we've nearly tripled the number of cities in our state that have discrimination protections for LGBTQ folks.
That's amazing. That's amazing stuff. A common thread that often comes up in these conversations is the difficulties in engaging communities of color, of having great representation on your board, in getting folks to step up and do this work, to reach out to communities of color in doing this work. Talk to me about those challenges and successes in Kentucky.
Well, we still struggle with it. Even though we've had an anti-racist lens in our work from the beginning, and we've always been intentional about making certain that activists and leaders of color are included in everything that we do and feel comfortable in our organization. Fairness is still seen as a white-led organization in many communities. Now, you know, about a third of our board are leaders of color. Both of our co-coordinators, our board chairs, are leaders of color. But nonetheless, LGBTQ organizations across the nation have been painted as white-led organizations. And that's because a lot of the folks who are in leadership positions look like me. We are white, gay men.
Yeah.
But what we do differently at the Fairness Campaign is talk about that in every space where we are. Anytime I am giving a presentation or doing an LGBTQ 101 at a corporation or for the Louisville Metro Police Department or with the city, I am intentional about talking about the intersections, talking about our commitment to anti-racism, and talking about the disproportionate outcomes for queer people of color in our communities. We're very vocal in the Black Lives Matter movement. We have consistently called out our police force when they have treated people of color disproportionately to the way they've treated other folks. And we'll continue to do that. You know, the way to create an open and a welcoming space is to make certain that we're being intentional about it being open and welcoming.
Yeah. Gosh, Chris, you make it seem like intersectionality is important.
That's twice now. I'll give you one more.
Yeah, I'm excited for the third one. I don't know when it's going to come up. Let's go with some highs and lows. Give me one of those times in working with Fairness Campaign that you just, either literally or figuratively, pumped your fist in the air and said, yes, look at what we just achieved.
Oh, my gosh. Every time we pass a new fairness ordinance in Kentucky, we went 10 years without any new fairness laws. We passed three in the late 90s and early 2000s. And then we had sort of a devastating decade during which time we lost the right to marry. Not that we ever had it, but we had a ballot referendum and lost that vote. So when BICO became the first city in 10 years to pass fairness, that was a feeling like no other. And then 6 months later, after a really intense battle in our state capital, Frankfort became the fifth city in Kentucky with fairness. And then right after that, we closed out the year by doubling the number of cities with fairness laws when Moorhead, the eastern Kentucky town that has now risen to national prominence because it is the county seat of Rowan County, where County Clerk Kim Davis had refused to issue marriage licenses until she was ultimately held in contempt and jailed. So that whole year, 2013, was really when things changed for fairness in Kentucky. And every time the various city councils voted to, you know, enshrine in law the protections that LGBTQ people deserve and to share with them the dignity and respect that everyone else had, those were just marvelous moments.
On the flip side, what's your magic wand moment? If you could wave it right now, what's the thing that you've not yet been able to achieve, but you think this has got to happen right now?
Oh, well, it's the continued statewide fairness law. You know, I would prefer not to be working in four and five different cities every week in an attempt to pass additional local fairness ordinances. We law that covers everybody who lives in our Commonwealth. Problem is that even though we know 83% of registered Kentucky voters support that type of law, still less than 17% of our state senators and House representatives are in support of fairness. So this is the uphill, craggy mountain climb that we've yet to be able to overcome. And so it continues to feel like a struggle.
All right. What's the next step? How do we plan a next step to addressing it?
Well, the next step still is that statewide fairness law. But, yeah, you know, the fairness campaign has a political component as well. We have a political action committee, and we're in the midst of a pretty heated gubernatorial race right now. Even though Kentucky's a red state, we consistently elect Democrats to many statewide constitutional offices. Our governor right now is a Democrat, our attorney general, our secretary of state, our state treasurer, our state auditor, all of them are Democrats. But there's no guarantee that Democratic Attorney General Jack Conway is going to win his gubernatorial race this year in 2015 against Tea Party candidate Matt Bevin. And marriage is at the forefront of all of this because Jack Conway, you know, sort of gained notoriety last year when he refused to defend Kentucky's ban on same-gender marriage as the state's attorney general. It was an emotional decision that he made, and it's one that is going to have some political ramifications, and we're going to do everything that we can to ensure that Jack Conway wins the gubernatorial race this year.
There it is. Now, I would imagine, having, you know, been slightly familiar with this work, that sometimes it gets a little bit trying. Is that
yes,
a fair assumption?
That's a remarkably fair assumption.
It's not my first day. How do you approach recharging?
Oh, it's been tough the past couple of years. You know, the beauty of all of the victories that we've been achieving with marriage equality and with all these municipal ordinances is that my work is not slowing down at all. And I thought it was busy 6.5 years ago when I first started. It's been tough to balance things. I do try to play a lot of Super Smash Brothers at home. It's sort of my Frank Underwood, you know, he beats the controllers on those war games. So I try to unwind in that way. I'll go play disc golf or, you know, hit the gym. But by and large, my mind is always racing.
No, that's not a metaphor. You actually play Super Smash Brothers.
It's true.
Okay, just checking. I don't know if it's some Kentucky metaphor that I don't know about yet.
It's not.
It's like a Woodford Reserve CJ Craig thing. Okay. Now, I don't want to out you, but it strikes me that you are in a specific, perhaps, and tell me if I'm wrong, 30 to 40-ish age range. How are we doing so
you're
far?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, you're smack dab in the middle. You got it.
So you are uniquely positioned to provide a perspective on a topic that we don't talk about nearly enough on this show, Chris, and that's about doing this work with an eye towards intergenerationality.
Right.
Bringing together different generations. How have you been successful in engaging folks who are both older than you, and then also, not to say that you don't represent the youth, Chris, but I have accepted at my tender age of 37 that perhaps I'm not 22 anymore. So how do you bring together these different populations?
Well, it's something we've been working directly to address. First, we've got tons of millennials who are our volunteers, who are our interns, who you know, are on the forefront of our civil rights movement here in Louisville and in all the cities in which we work. We have launched a task force and have been working for about a year and a half to achieve a SAGE affiliate in Kentucky, which doesn't exist currently. SAGE is Services and Advocacy for Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Elders. Mm-hmm. So we've been getting through the benchmarks to achieve the SAGE affiliate. And one of the themes that we kept hearing from old and young alike is that they wanted some opportunities for intergenerational socializing and organizing. So I think we're really going to be seeing some programs geared towards that in the next year as we launch our SAGE affiliate in December. But by and large, we're just intentional that all of our events are open to everyone, and we really do have a diverse crowd at everything that we do. Whenever we throw a fundraiser or a party, we're very clear that the cost should never be a barrier for folks to come, and we often try to choose venues where a wide variety of ages can come and enjoy.
Nice. Do you have the opportunity to work with other states?
Yes, far more so now. So Fairness Campaign just recently became Kentucky's statewide advocacy organization. Even though we're getting ready to celebrate our 25th anniversary, we were, by and large, a Louisville-based organization. Though from the time that I was hired in 2009, we had really been doing a lot of statewide work. But we became officially statewide in 2013 when the former Kentucky Fairness Alliance, which was a statewide group, merged its assets into ours. At that point in time, we became the state's member organization in the National Equality Federation. And that has given us the opportunity to connect on a regular basis with other state organizations and state leaders. Actually, just last month, I became one of the newest board members to the National Equality Federation's board. So now we have the opportunity to share our victories and our losses, what worked, what didn't, especially around things like the anti-transgender bathroom bill that we fought and defeated here in Kentucky this year during our General Assembly. We were the first state to face one of those bathroom bills, and it's been invaluable. I guess I shouldn't say it's been invaluable, but other folks have shared with us that it's been invaluable for us to have shared with them the experiences that we had during that battle and what worked for us and what didn't work. Because we've also been very candid about the mistakes that we made along the way and how other folks can avoid those pitfalls.
I will ask you what I've asked so many before you, and it's the important piece here. We have all these folks listening. What can they do to assist in your efforts?
They've got to just stay engaged and read the news, which is unavoidable now since it's in everyone's Facebook feed.
Right.
You know, following groups like Fairness Campaign on Twitter at Fairness Camp or on Facebook gives folks the opportunity to engage with us instantaneously, because that's where we release the information first. Whenever someone's trying to take our rights away or whenever we're trying to move something forward in a positive way, we will let everybody know immediately what phone calls they need to make, what emails they need to send, what events we'd like for folks to show up at. Sometimes half of being engaged is literally just where you put your body, which is why we say it's so important that, you know, I'm not working in all of these communities from Louisville. I'm actually driving 4 hours to get to Harlan County so that we can actually settle in and work there. Showing up is the most important thing folks can do. And even if it's just a social event, the people that you'll meet and the connections that you'll make help you build those relationships that will assist you in engaging in LGBTQ advocacy work where you live.
And finally, my favorite part of having these chats, I give you the floor, Chris Hartman, to extol the virtues of your board, your volunteers, and your staff.
Oh, they're marvelous. I couldn't ask for anything more. I literally could not have done this for nearly 7 years without them. When I was hired, I said, 5 to 7 years is my goal. After the first year, I said 2 to 3. I can maybe make it 2 to 3. But because I've had such, you know, remarkable support from our board of directors who have been with me every step of the way and been with me in those really tough times and have had volunteers who oftentimes, some of our volunteers are practically full-time and devote, you know, 20, 30, up to 40 hours a week to this work just out of the goodness of their hearts. Nonprofits like ours, we're so small, we only have 2.5 staff members, 2 full-time, 1 part-time staff member to cover the 4.4 million people that live in Kentucky. We would never be able to function without volunteers and board members who remain committed to our cause.
There it is. By the way, does this count as my interview for the administrative coordinator position?
It does.
Okay.
I do still need to see that resume, though.
Oh, crap. All right. Well, we'll just leave it there then for now. In the meantime, listeners, we need you to stroll on over to fairness.org. It's that simple, fairness.org. Chris, on behalf of all of us who are watching you guys do this incredible work, where I might remind our listeners, intersectionality is important, this is incredible stuff. This is where we are bringing together the community, where you guys are standing up there in Kentucky and letting the rest of us watch you as you stand up proudly and say, look, this is how communities work together. This is how we can achieve progress, and there's no way that we can do it on our own. It's really quite inspiring, Chris.
Well, Ken, I've been inspired just chatting with you, and have also been inspired to go home and watch a little bit more West Wing.
You know what? If I make that kind of a difference in the world, I go to bed happy. Chris, on behalf of all of our listeners, everybody in Kentucky, and everybody who's watching you guys do the great work that you guys are doing, we thank you.
Ken, I thank you very much.
That, my friends, is everything we have going on for this week's episode of This Show Is So Gay. Our huge, huge thanks to AJ Bockelman. Our huge, huge thanks to Chris Hartman. You guys, I hope you're inspired. Get out there. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?